Right, it's the great and the wonderful Leslie Young.
What's going on, Black Kids family? This is Brother Malcolm, and welcome to another edition of Culture Connection. I am thrilled today because I have a very, very special guest. We're going to start a new segment called Angelino Cultural Jewels, and I would be remiss if I didn't start off with one of my greatest influence mentors, one of the finest Angelinos the city has ever produced, the founder and producer of Ebony Repertory Theater. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a round of applause for Mr. Ren Troy Brown.
Malcolm, thank you very, very much for that very, very generous introduction. I am truly honored to be here with you tonight and to be a part of this extraordinary endeavor called Culture Connection. I'm very, very happy to be here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Ren and I go back a few years, not that many, but we met in 2007 on a phone call. Where Ren was calling me. I'd just gotten off a flight off of a Chitlin Circuit gospel tour, and Ren wanted to meet with me, and I was insistent that I could not meet that evening, and he said, we must meet, and I said, no, and it will forever go down in history as our first meeting. The moment we met and you took me to Ebony Repertory Theater at the Nate Holden Performing Arts Center, I was blown away, and the vision and the foresight you've had for Ebony Rep and the Mid-City community has been extraordinary. And I wanted to talk to you specifically because you have such a legacy in this city. Is it a fourth generation Angelino?
I am a fourth generation Angelino, yes.
It would be great if you could just talk to the audience about your family's legacy in Los Angeles and what that has meant to you and how that informs how you produce and create art right now.
Well, firstly, my great-grandmother, Mrs. Dorothy Gibbons, my mother's mother's mother, was born here in Los Angeles in 1890. Hmm. She was born at 24th and Maple, and her parents had married here in 1882. So that was the first of the line being born. And then my grandmother was born here in Los Angeles in 1911. My mother was born here in Los Angeles sometime in the 30s. I shall not give her date. She is living and would not want that.
I greatly appreciate that you didn't do that.
Absolutely. But then my siblings began to be born in the 50s. And now our three children have been born in Los Angeles. So in terms of the familial line here on my mother's side, we are now five generations born in Los Angeles proper. But that knowing of home, that feeling that this is something that really does belong to me and to our family has been very germane to the confidence that I've possessed throughout my life. I think confidence is germane to the success of anyone. I think it's very dangerous when it brims over into arrogance or conceit or condescension or that kind of, you know, territorial imperative that way. I certainly share this terra firma with many, but I do feel as though I belong here. Sweat equity has been paid on these streets of Los Angeles. I've watched the city and its migratory patterns historically. And so that has really, really informed my art growing up on the East Side. Mm-hmm. A lot of people pejoratively call what we call the East Side South Central now. But the East Side was a really, really rich Black community where you would have a plumber on one street, an eventual first Nobel laureate in Dr. Ralph Bunche. You would have an artist, you would have a school teacher and a truant officer. So the entire Black community lived together and on the same streets. And so there was not that kind of divide for many years. And that's the kind of cultural environment I came out of. I was raised into that. I was raised with a tremendous respect for the grandparent generation and what that represented. But it has greatly, greatly impacted my art because the stories, the Black people are so soulful.
Wow.
We are so soulful. And so it has just really been a joy unspeakable for me to really sit at the feet of the elders. Mm. And I have done that. I was always attracted to the older people within my family and outside of the family. So I've just been a repository and I've been at the feet of the elders. And that has greatly, greatly informed my sensibilities. And that's what we try to offer in terms of the vision and the foresight and the construction of what the Ebony Repertory Theater is.
Now, because I know a little bit of this history, but it'd be great for our audiences to get a little bit of that familial history. Can you talk about your grandparents and their sort of the rich historical significance of their careers and their life?
Certainly. I'd like to start with my mother's line again, since they were based here in Los Angeles first. My grandmother, Ruth Gibbons by birth, was a torch singer and a chorus dancer. She was a bit player in early Hollywood films, as early as the early 30s. Mm-hmm. But she worked all of the great niteries, as they used to call them here in Los Angeles and down in San Diego, where they referred to them as au fait nightclubs, meaning white nightclubs. Mm. But she was a torch singer and a dancer, mm-hmm. And just an absolute jewel in my life. My mother's father, Lee Young Sr., became the first black staff musician in the history of Hollywood, 1943 Columbia Pictures. He was born into a theatrical family. His father, Willis Handy Young, had a troupe at the turn of the 20th century called the New Orleans Strutters. His older sister was Irma Young. She was a dancer and a saxophonist and singer. And their older brother was the seminal Lester Young, the great tenor saxophonist, who also began as a dancer and a multi-instrumentalist. And their parents and their uncles and aunts and cousins all were musicians as a part of the New Orleans Strutters. My grandfather, Lee Young Sr., his first major job recording was with Fats Waller. His first recording sessions ever were at the famous door, which was on Vine, just north of Melrose, where actually where Rossmore turns into Melrose. The club was called the Famous Door, and he recorded there in 1937 with Fats Waller. But in 1936, he was the drummer for the great Ethel Waters. Mm. And so that's just kind of an overview of those two grandparents. Mm-hmm. My paternal grandmother was born Bertha McElroy in Mobile, Alabama. But she found her way through Pensacola, Florida, then to Philadelphia, and she became a dancer in Philadelphia. And she found her way to New York City and began to work with Irving C. Miller and his brown skin models. I find records of her performing as early as 1924 professionally. And then my father's father, Troy Brown Sr., was born in 1900 on March 17th in Memphis, Tennessee. He was the fifth black actor in Screen Actors Guild. He was a blackface comedian. He worked with partners for many, many years. He worked as a single then for many years, and he was a contract player, had a 7-year contract in the 30s with David O. Selznick, and they did so many films together, films like Nothing Sacred with Carol Lombard and Frederick March. Mm-hmm. He did Can This Be Dixie, Angel's Holiday, worked with Tyrone Power, worked with Otto Preminger in his first film called Under Your Spell, and so had a really, really rich legacy on stages across the world. He traveled on the SS Paris. He played the London Palladium. He played Broadway twice. And so that is the kind of all four grandparents with theatricals, and they all knew one another at one time or another.
The reason why I wanted you to give us that that sort of precursor to your own personal career, because I truly believe, and I think you do as well, that we sort of stand on the giants that come before us. And I believe that your family obviously has been an incredible influence on your life. And I wanted to talk about Ebony Repertory Theater is the first African-American equity company in the history of Los Angeles. And for those who don't know what that means it's under an actor's equity contract. And all of the actors are paid a living wage, and that Ebony Repertory Theater contributes to their pension and health. And I wanted you just to talk about this commitment that you have to the Mid-City community. It's quite inspiring, and it's part of the reason why I love the mission of Ebony Rep and what you're doing at the Nate Holden Performing Arts Center. And I was wondering if you could just talk about that fire that sort of burns in you for the Mid-City community and where that all, you know, what's the genesis of that?
Well, I was born and raised in the Mid-City community that you speak of. I was born at 1926 Rempaul Boulevard, June 11th, 1964 at 5:03 p.m. I was born at John Wesley Hospital, but I returned home to that address. And so I am raised 150 yards from where the Nate Holden Performing Arts Center sits. I call it theatrical terra firma because since the 20s, it was a 750-seat single screen Art Deco movie house called the Metro Theater. Mm-hmm. It was originally called the Rempaugh Theater. Then it became the Metro. Then a broadcast called Jazz at the Metro used to come from that site. And then in 1950, at a separate site, the Ebony Showcase Theater was formed by Mr. Nick and Edna Stewart. Mr. Nick Stewart had been lightning on Amos and Andy, and he and my grandfather, Troy Brown, were actually in Swingin' in the Dream together in 1939 mm-hmm. on Broadway. But there was such a dearth of opportunity on the stages and positive images on the stages of Los Angeles that he and Mrs. Stewart founded in 1950 the Ebony Showcase Theater to shed light, positive light, on the black community and black artists. Mm-hmm. Well, in 1965 or 66, the property at 4718 West Washington Boulevard, where the Nate Holden Performing Arts Center now sits, the Stewart family purchased it, and it became the Ebony Showcase Theater. In about 1968, when I was 4 years old, walking with my three brothers and my sister, I said to my sister, I said, Wilda, what is that? And she said, that's a marquee. And it said Ebony Showcase Theater. And so that's the first theatrical marquee that ever really stood out in my mind. Mm. And so when it came to the formation of the Ebony Repertory Theater, I wanted to honor the first marquee and that first impact on my life that I had ever seen. I was considering naming the company the Apex Repertory Theater in honor of the Apex Club on Central Avenue, which then became the Club Alabama. Mm-hmm. But I realized that my grandparents, the four of them, they had all been greatly impacted by the Apex Club. But I thought about, Ren, what has impacted your life? Mm-hmm. And so seeing that marquee and knowing what the Stewart family was attempting to do all those years was greatly impactful on my life. And so that's how the name came. But the community that I grew up in there in the mid-city, particularly along Washington Boulevard, was so rich in diversity. And I'm talking about diversity of thought, diversity of income, and diversity of ethnic groups. I mean, we had a Japanese presence. We had a very small white presence. Disproportionately, the community was black that I grew up in, but we also had a Mexican presence. Mm-hmm. And I say that specifically because now we use the broad, ubiquitous term Latino. But at that time, you could really, really drill down and say that it was a Mexican population because that's where it was. Mm-hmm. We did not have people from El Salvador and people from Colombia and other countries where the Latino term would come from.
Right.
So we had a community that had all the goods and services that any community would want. We had supermarket. We had boot blacks, if you will. We had two very strong.
What is a boot black?
A boot black are people who work on shoes, shoe shine parlors.
Oh, there we go. Thank you for those of us who don't know what boot blacks are.
And so we had the neighborhood shoe shine parlor mm-hmm. with Reverend Broadnax. And then we had, of course, Mr. Meredith was down the street at Bamboo mm-hmm. Shoe Shine Parlor. We had another one with Papa, who was right on Rempaugh, Darling Cleaners, Mr. Darling. Mm-hmm. We had the Lake and Drugstore, Dr. and Mrs. Lee, and L.A. Liquor. We had ShopRite Supermarket across the street that was really, really came to be in the early 70s because of the seminal civic leader, Ted Watkins, who really had a base in Watts, but he was a social activist and a brilliant, brilliant civic leader. And so ShopRite Supermarket was there. We had Bank of America, Crocker Citizens Bank, right on Washington Boulevard within those three or four blocks of the theater.
Wow, really?
Yeah, we had Tommy Tucker's Playroom, which was okay. at Highland in Washington, where great musicians would come and great mm-hmm. food was eaten. On the corner of La Brea and Washington was the Parisian Room. And attached to it was Francis's Drive-In, where you could come up and get some of the best French fries you ever had in your life. Mm-hmm. Right there, you would drive up. But also coming back east, right across from where the theater is presently, there was the It Club. And one of the finest remote recordings in the history of jazz is Thelonious Monk live at the It Club, 1964. But the It Club was run by John T. McLean. And next door to it was a wonderful little eatery run by Mrs. Waverly Jackson. And unfortunately, I'm sad to report that Mrs. Waverly Jackson just passed on the 6th of July, I believe it was. Wow. But she prepared the best hamburger to this day that I've ever eaten. And I loved her.
Hands down?
Hands down, without question.
There's no one who has ever made a better burger than her.
Not in my lifetime that I've had a chance to...
That's saying a lot.
No, yeah, trust me, and I've
because
eaten far too many burgers
had
in my
many,
life.
We've had many, many.
Burgers together.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, Miss Waverly, unfortunately, you missed that. But also then going further east, there was the Hillcrest Club, mm-hmm. Where free jazz with Ornette Coleman
now,
and
were
others.
Now, are we past Crenshaw at this point?
No. We're at Hillcrest.
This is all still Crenshaw, between Crenshaw and La Brea?
This is between West Boulevard and La Brea. So right in the heart of the mid-city was the Hillcrest Club. Mm. So this was a rich and vibrant cultural, artistic community that just fed my soul. It just fed my soul. You know, my father being a bebop trumpeter and jazz musician and my family's history. So I was connected to and attracted to those things. Mm. I remember very specifically going to a date at Fauché Junior High School with my father. And at about 8 years old, this non-sung music called jazz that was swinging so hard from a bebop perspective, it really clicked to me one day at about eight, because I used to go to those sessions with my father and I couldn't understand why words were not spoken, why words were not sung. Mm. But that day, somehow, you know, the magic happened, the fire happened, and the band was swinging and it touched my heart in a very specific way. And so I'm committed to that community, because as I like to say, and I'd like to borrow this from a play called Fraternity, written by Jeff Stetson, that I am not for you because you're for me. I am for you because you are me. And that is the Mid-City community. That is the community that nurtured me, informed my life, and reconstituted my entire essence. Mm. It's home.
Mm. I mean, one of the reasons why I wanted you to be the inaugural cultural jewel is because I think so many of us are deficient in our history, our familial history, our communal history, our city's history. And it's just, it's such a pleasure and a joy just to listen to you dig deep into the annals of your family's cultural history. And it really is Angeleno history, it's Black history, it's American history, and it's really, really exciting. And honestly, just I thank you for holding on to your family's legacy. So many of us don't even know our familial legacy, and I think it's so important to continue that.
Well, thank you, Malcolm. Very quickly, I'd like to say that one of the things, particularly for anyone entering the theatrical business, we call it show business, I think it's so germane to the success of anyone that they really come to this industry with a sense of self-definition. And I was blessed beyond measure to enter this industry with a strong sense of self, with a strong awareness of who I was, where and who I had come from. It aided me tremendously. And so even without this particular theatrical legacy in someone's life, coming to this industry with a real sense of self-definition will hold you in very good stead, because you do not want this industry of great commercialism to begin to define who you are, because I think that you might find yourself laying like a carcass on the side of the road in a few years if you allow an industry and a medium that has not always treated Black, brown, and beige people well. If you allow that industry to define who you are, you might find yourself tremendously injured. So I just wanted to jump in and share that piece.
No, I agree. And one of the other things I would add is that integrity is a huge part of that. And that's part, probably a huge reason why I believe Ebony Repertory Theater is so successful, is because there's an integrity to the art, there's an integrity to the leadership, and there's an integrity to how the company has come about and how it continues to carry itself. I had another question, but I want you to talk a little bit about Israel Hicks for a moment. Who is Israel Hicks, for those who may not know who our beloved Israel Hicks is?
Israel Theo Hicks Jr., born on the 23rd of August, 1943, was our founding artistic director. One of the finest men God ever put breath in. A brilliant artist, trained at Boston University in the 60s, then went on to take his master's in directing at New York University, trained under the great Lloyd Richards. Of course, Lloyd Richards, Mr. Lloyd Richards had directed the 1959 Broadway production of A Raisin in the Sun. Israel, for the last 10 years, was the chairman of the Mason Gross School of the Arts at Rutgers University, but for 20 years prior to that, he was the dean at SUNY Purchase, and so he trained for 30 years a couple of generations worth of artists. He worked in the regional theaters. He worked in on Broadway. Israel was a man of immutable principle. He had such taste. He was so brilliant. He was so generous. And when we were able to come together at the insistence of the brilliant Tony Award-winning actor Roger Robinson, Israel and Rentroy Brown were immediately so well met And we began to really, really talk this vision through that we would eventually write down on paper. But Israel, his taste, his countenance, the poet said, and he kept the noiseless tenor of his way, was such a gentle man, such a quiet man, but possessing of so much power, so much stature. He really laid the artistic imprint on this city where Ebony Repertory Theater is concerned. And so holding up that standard is absolutely before us every single day that we exist. Mm-hmm. We have to maintain the standard that Israel Hicks maintained. And we always have to be theatrical archaeologists. Mm-hmm. We have to dig. And Israel was always in search of truth. That was his singular goal in the work. He always wanted nothing to get in the way of the work. And he wanted the work to really, really be about truth, because he believed that you could not tell lies off stage and go on stage and tell the truth. Mm-hmm. And so that is just a small capsule of who Israel Theo Hicks Jr. was. And in fact, he still is.
Mr. Hicks, ihicks23@aol.com.
That's right.
I was so grateful to have met Israel and to have seen his artistry in his direction of Two Trains Running and of Crowns. And he just did such a masterful job on those two productions. So speaking of art and the artistic process, I'm curious, just because you are so well-traveled, you are a man of the arts. I mean, you have truly have your hand in music and dance and theater. So many people probably know you as an actor and a producer, but many don't know you as the board member. You're an advisory board member of Complexions Contemporary Dance, correct?
That is correct. They claim that I am the co-chairman of that board, in fact.
Excuse me. That was a little bit of a read, ladies and gentlemen.
I
didn't do my research.
That was not a read at all. Not a read at all.
It wasn't. There's nothing but love between these two gentlemen. And so I wanted you to talk about... I've always been curious. I don't think I've ever asked you this question. And if I did, my memory doesn't serve me well right now. Can you tell us... a particular artistic moment that has sort of left an indelible, not sort of, has left an indelible impression on you in your lifetime?
Oh, there are many. There are so many.
I'll give you three if you can say them quickly. Otherwise, I want one.
No, you can get one.
No, I kind of want three now. But I'll take one.
You're going to get one. I specifically remember going to the Amundsen Theater in about 1975, I believe it was. I was 11 years old. And I remember going there with my grandmother, Ruth Givens, my mother. And the First National Company of the Wiz had opened. And to see the brilliance of that show and that company. Downtown Los Angeles at the Music Center, which is such a jewel to our city.
Yes.
But for many, it possesses a kind of austerity and a lack of welcome.
Right.
But to see black people and black culture, black directors, black designers, black choreographers, black artists, dancers, actors, and singers, reimagining that Wizard of Oz tale that we would watch every single year in Technicolor with the great Judy Garland and all the others. What a brilliant film. But to have that music written by the late, great Charlie Smalls, sung by that company, acted and danced, it was just spectacular. It was spectacular. It changed my life. It was so rich. It made me so proud. I was unabashedly proud that my people, I saw myself reflected on that stage. I saw myself with great dimension. I saw my culture present on that stage, and I saw my culture being honored on that stage. And so beyond all of the artistic brilliance that transpired within that production, I was sent home with a greater sense of self, a greater belief in the possibility mm-hmm. of what this life could be, and how the art of the theater was truly transformative. And so that's the one that mm-hmm. I would share.
Mm. I'm so happy it was a piece of theater, too. I'm a huge advocate for those who listen to the show. I'm always on my soapbox about supporting the theater, not the theater. We learned that in Theater Etiquette Parts 1 and 2. It's the theater, but the theater, I don't know where that comes from. Is that pronunciation? Ren is holding back a laugh right now. We have had some experiences at the theater with people calling it the theater. So this is about, I think we're both unabashedly proud Angelenos. I'm wondering, who's your greatest Angeleno influence?
My greatest Angeleno influence, my goodness, that's very difficult. I'd like for you to drill down very specifically, if you wouldn't mind, because I could take this many directions, but I'd like for you to drill down a little more specifically, please.
What Angeleno has had the greatest influence on your life, Mr. Brown?
Oh, that was a very slight variation on what you asked the first time. You really didn't drill down with great specificity.
No, I did not. I don't want to, because I already think I know who the answer is.
Well, I will have to tell you that my life has had no greater influence than my maternal grandfather. Mm-hmm. My grandfather, Mr. Lee Young Sr., Leonidas Raymond Young Sr., born on the 7th of March, 1914 in New Orleans, Louisiana. I cannot imagine my life without my grandfather's presence, without his influence mm-hmm. on my life. Mm-hmm. He was an extraordinary human being, and he was such a man. He was such an artist. He was such a man of dignity and grace and integrity and intelligence. Grandpa Lee had vast exposure. He had traveled this country. He had seen 40 states by the time he was 12. My grandfather performed his art in over 80 countries of the world. He played the inauguration as a drummer with the Nat King Cole Trio at the John F. Kennedy inauguration. He was a tremendous athlete. He was a wonderful, wonderful golfer. But he correlated everything that he shared, or everything he taught, was aligned with music, which was his life. He, as a child, working with his father in the New Orleans Strutters, was a young three-year-old as a blackface comedian, but a dancer and a singer who eventually became an exquisite drummer. My grandfather, the exposure to cuisine, the exposure to the nuances of language, the exposure to a real deep love of self, mm-hmm. His encouragement of humility was extraordinary. I cannot imagine anyone who will ever have, if I live another 80 years, I don't think I will have anyone influence me in the way that my grandfather has. There are three others who come nearest, and I've been so blessed. I've had such a rich, rich existence. The three others who come nearest to the influence of my grandfather are my three children, mm-hmm. Because I think children have the capacity for teaching a parent in a way like no one else can. Mm. It's a unique relationship. It is a dynamic relationship. There is such a sacred kind of quality to that relationship. It is a sacrosanct relationship. And if parents are really, really, really interested in growing, children can teach you in a way like no one else can. Mm. And so those influences, I've been greatly influenced by many, and I know, but drilling down on that singular Angeleno, Leonidas Raymond Young Sr. is the acme. He's the top of the heap, Grandpa Lee.
And what a testament you are to his legacy.
Thank you.
So, Ebony Repertory Theater is part of a huge arts community, obviously, but it's specifically part of a black arts community. And I was just wondering if you could talk about the single greatest issue facing the black arts community in 2012. Is there Is there something that's so pressing and urgent that we all have to address in our artistry, in our institutions, in our companies, that if we don't, could affect us 20 years, 30, 50 years from now?
Does that make sense? Yes. Okay. I think for the arts community to sustain itself, we have to earnestly cultivate an audience. Mm-hmm. And not only an audience of our direct peers or our contemporaries, but we need to cultivate and develop, obviously, a younger audience. We have to teach through the work that we do. We have to, through our work, respectfully demand certain standards. We need to cultivate an audience because I think that Black culture is being so profoundly diluted because people are on a pilgrimage to just be human. Mm-hmm. Well, we've always been human. There are those who, in major, major, major pieces of literature that define what America is, where we were once called three-fifths human, we have treaties, language, slave schedules, some of the most wretched, wretched institutions who have historically attempted to define us as a people. Mm-hmm. But I am an African American, and that's the term in the nomenclature that's used today, but I'm a Black man. I'm connected to Negro people. I'm connected to colored people. Mm. I'm connected to spooks. I'm connected to jigaboos. I'm connected to all of those things, both savory and unsavory, that have been the Black experience. I'm not separate of any of those things. And I believe that we need to teach through our work the real kaleidoscopic nature of who we have been as a people. And I believe we have to bring an audience along, whether it's in our painting, whether it's in our present presentation of ourselves through hip-hop and all the forms that hip-hop can take, mm-hmm. The theater, lectures, whether it's the kinds of books that we write, the films that we make. I believe we have to earnestly cultivate an audience because we've been greatly pillaged, mm-hmm. and we need to hold on to ourselves, and we need to hold on to one another, not have our fingers far, you know, spread far apart, mm-hmm. but we need to close it down in a fist-like fashion and retain a sense of being an accumulated entity, mm-hmm. that we have to be together, a solid, solid community. And so I really believe it's about telling the truth and shaming the devil about who we are, who we have been, and who we're going to be. The blueprint for our macro success has already been drawn. We just have to go back and honor the blueprint. We don't need to reinvent the wheel.
Right.
We often deal in historical discontinuity. Mm-hmm. So as you stated earlier, Malcolm, it's about going back, whether it's in your familial background or just in the background of your community, your people, and really, really going back and digging and finding. And we have so many people and so many instances that are worthy of celebration. We need to go and find those things that are not immediately on our radar that way. And so with that said, I think we have to cultivate a community of people who respect and honor certain standards that the folks of yesteryear held in the face of extraordinary odds.
Mm.
And they held on to their immutable principles, their dignity, and their grace. And they shed blood, and many died, literally and figuratively, so that we could sit here today and have this kind of conversation. So that's what I believe.
Mm. As they do in the poetry slams. Mm. I'm gonna...
That offends me to the soul.
I love it. I love it. We're going to finish up now, but I do want to say, when it's all said and done, and people talk about the legacy of Ren Troy Brown, what would you want to be said about your legacy?
If the word generosity could be associated with me, I would appreciate that greatly. I've attempted to be generous in my life. I have never wanted to be the only one anywhere. Mm-hmm. I have never wanted to be that singular big man. I've always wanted to share the joys of my life, the exposures of my life, the experiences of my life. Mm. I believe that we should give forward. I know that we hear often that, you know, so-and-so gave back, But I think we need to reconstitute what that language is now. I think we should absolutely give forward. And that's what I try to do every single day of my life. I draw inspiration from people who are unaware that they are inspiring me. I met a couple today who have a son just under 5 years old. And just in the spirit of their reception, the spirit and the joy in their faces, the energy possessed in their embrace and their handshake, the joy, separate and distinct from happiness, found in their smiles, I have found great encouragement in the meeting of this young family. So I believe that, again, if generosity could be aligned with my name, if someone could suggest that I was a man of the people, that I was really earnestly a man of the people, that would honor me, you know, to the very ends of the earth. So there.
Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Ren Troy Brown, thank you so much for coming by and making time for us here at Culture Connection on Black Is Online. If you are in the LA area in the month of October through November, please check out Fraternity at Ebony Repertory Theater. Is it the West Coast premiere?
The Los Angeles premiere.
The Los Angeles premiere of Fraternity by playwright Jeff Stetson. Ebony Repertory Theater always, always puts on outstanding, phenomenal, excellent productions of plays written by people of color, specifically Black folk.
Malcolm K. Darrell, this is not an addendum, but may I say this? I love you.
Uh-oh.
And there's nothing that you can do about that. And you inspire me daily. And I want you to know that.
Thank you.
It's important that I say that. And so before I go, I will once again say that I am he who signs his name indelibly on the epidermis of actuality as Ren Troy Brown. Thank you for having me.
And as we end every week on Culture Connection, remember to make a career out of humanity. Commit yourself to the noble struggle for equal rights. You will make a greater person of yourself, a greater nation of your country, and a finer world to live in. Thank you for tuning in. Hope to see you next week on Culture Connection. Peace.